Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now on the podcast, Ralph Hildenbeutel, who alongside Sven Feit created some of the most groundbreaking music of the 90s, and Ralph's still at it. If you've seen Super Sex on Netflix, then you've heard his latest soundtrack.
The vision was, I think, that there was no vision really in that sense. You have this guy coming from DJing, and then you have this musicians who are always thinking chords and harmonies and stuff like this, and both sides telling each other, open your mind. I never would have done this in that way on an ambient record. I would have thought too much about things. Can I do it or not? And then Sven was on the other side. You can do everything. I've been lucky to be there because you have to be in the right time and the right place as well to do this. And it happened. And this is rare. Everybody knows when I say Rocco Siffredi, everyone says, Rocco Siffredi. So I Googled Rocco Siffredi. I was like, oh, okay, here we go. it's the scene, it's a cue, it's a situation which needs a music. Director has a vision, producer has a vision, Netflix has a vision.
Don't go away, Ralph Hildenbeutel coming up in just a second. But please subscribe. It helps me and it allows you to be the first when I load something new up on this channel. Okay, here's Ralph Hildenbeutel. So Ralph Hildenbeutel, welcome. Where are you?
Hello, thanks for inviting me. I'm in Frankfurt now.
Were you born in Frankfurt?
I was born in Frankfurt, actually, and I've been a lot of around, but the main base is still Frankfurt, actually, yeah.
What sort of music were you brought up around with your parents?
Okay, that's interesting. Because I never liked what they listened to, kind of. And when I started to listen to music, and I started with the piano at 9, so quite early I was into music, but I liked classical music through the piano lessons, but also jazz and all this kind of stuff.
What were their tastes?
Well, it was not Schlager, but kind of stuff I considered cheesy or boring or too far away. I can give you even names. I don't know. It would have been like this really a generation thing. It was the opposite of what I wanted to listen to.
I mean, you said you went to piano lessons at 9. Were you like me, where although it was sort of a semi-choice on my behalf, it was more the choice of my mother, or was it you wanted to do that?
No, actually, it was I wanted to do that. My grandmother had an organ and a piano at her house, and I always used to go there and play around. And so they offered me the option to say, do you want to learn an instrument? My brother as well. So I chose the piano while he took the guitar, and I was immediately obsessed, kind of. And we had the lucky situation. There was a piano teacher living in the same building. So she came to us once a week, and they really had to kind of, we had this damper in the piano to make it more not so loud, which I hated these times, because they said you cannot play the whole day. So that was a lucky situation. So, but I kind of wanted to really to do it. Yeah.
Was your grandmother culturally interested, or did she just have a piano around?
She just more or less had a piano around because her husband used to play, was in music, but I never met him. And so she wasn't really a musician at all, but it was just there, and I always used the stuff.
So this piano teacher, this woman that taught you the piano, was she in effect a bit of a mentor to you as well?
It was interesting because she was quite young, and I stayed with her, I think, 10 years. And she taught me a lot of stuff, not just pure piano pieces from classical side, because she saw that I also had interest in a little bit more modern stuff, jazzy stuff, and she was quite open to pick Ragtime from Scott Joplin, whatever, and go a bit in this session. And she also taught me a lot of stuff towards music theory. I learned how to write a choral, like from the 16th century and stuff like this. So I took quite a lot of, she was giving me lots of input, which I used later. And I remembered often, it's good that I learned that while I had the piano lessons.
I mean, it does sound like she sort of, your interests were quite broad in any case, I think, but she obviously broadened your interests even more. But you mentioned that you were very interested in jazz at a young age. And it may be a cliche to say this, but often people are interested in jazz at an older age because it's a very sophisticated music form. So it's quite unusual to be interested in jazz at a young age, don't you think?
I don't know how this came, where this, my father, some of the few stuff I like was like Benny Goodman or even James Last records, because with the brasses, when I did like a bit jazzy but in a cheesy style. And I think through that I slipped more into the real jazz stuff, Count Basie, name them, I hope, or the piano players, and I made tape recordings from radio, and I was really into it somehow. I don't know why, because as you say, it's a bit weird in a young age to like this kind of stuff.
So there you are, you're learning piano, you're interested in different styles of music. What did your parents, and often our parents want us to be something, they want us to be something stable, where we have a fixed income, where we're going to be okay. And if you go down a cultural path, you're often not fulfilling their wishes. So what did they want you to be? And were they supportive in your choices as you started to grow?
It's interesting, it has been kind of a diverse thing, because they supported me a lot with doing music, and they saw that I was really into it. And with 14, I started to play in the school bands, and I got more and more into music. And with 16, I was in studios already, and they even took me out of school for a couple of days to do some recording somewhere. On the other side, of course, it was music. You're not the safe thing. You're never going to really make money with it. And they expected me to do some, to learn some, to study something proper. And when I finished school, I told them, yeah, I can go study, learn piano teacher or whatsoever. And they thought, cool, but I never did it. And once they recognized that this was just like talking from my side, we had some really tough times, but I could prove them different, luckily.
You said you were in school bands at that period. What did, you know, and you mentioned also like the piano teacher over that period had a big influence later on your knowledge and what you could do later. What influence did being in the bands have, and where did that really come from? Was it performing live? What was it?
I think it was there's the piano thing, and mainly classical pieces, and it's One Direction. And I had this interest in doing something more modern, playing in bands, having a keyboard was one of my biggest wishes then, till I got my first, I think it was a Casio keyboard for my parents, and playing bands, do modern music. At that time, it was more like rock, synth, rock, orientated stuff, bass stuff. But yeah, I was like several directions, kind of. I never was like really this like just classical guy, or just, and now I just go modern or electronic. So it's, the interest was so big to do other things as well.
I mean, one thing for me when I was a teenager, I think it was really clear that music was also an escape from my parents' world, or even for me, from the world in which I was in, to a world that I wanted to go to. Was music ever an escape for you?
Yeah, sure. I think quite, yes, definitely. In both ways, from not from my parents, but from my parents' world, which was, I had an other idea of living, kind of, from style, from taste and stuff like this, just. And also I was not like a super shy guy, but I was more calm always. And with playing with in bands and doing music, I could let go on another level, which always helped me a lot, and always was kind of an escape from the other side.
I mean, because you were so into music, I just wondered whether you were a fairly isolated child at school. Were you a loner, or were you, you know, surrounded by a lot of friends? Because you obviously you have to spend a lot of time with music.
Well, no, I wasn't alone, actually. I was doing quite well with my social life. But when it started with the bands, you orientate to, you look for people around you who do also music. And then it very quickly became other guys or girls from outside school, not from the same class. And so you have your own posse or people around you, and more after year, it became more and more, I was more isolated from school. I had good friends at school, no doubt, but you get into your own world, of course. And then when you start to do your first studio jobs or recordings or with the other bands playing, so a complete different scene than the people around you in school. Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that I think you were in a studio when you were about 17. So what was your first experience of production, and how did that come about?
Couldn't really say like one first experience, because I quite early started to do stuff at home, like classically, like the tape to tape stuff, because I was fascinated by how kind of layer keyboard sounds and stuff like this. And then when we had the rehearsal room, I often went there by myself to do, what do you call it over there, demos, like trying multi-track layering stuff. And then we did record band demos in studios. I was fascinated by the whole recording producing process. And then I started to do, at a certain point, demo productions for artists on a low level. It went really step by step, on very slow steps. So I don't have this one aha effect situation in the studio. It just came slowly but surely.
But did you always have confidence? Because when I'm sort of looking into your story, it does feel it's such a young, you know, you were so young doing certain things. I mean, even let's talk about Baldersalz, the comedy duo in Germany from Hessen. Yeah. And you produced an album for them at a very young age. And I just wonder, you know, how much confidence you need to have? Or was it that you were so young that you never really thought about confidence, you just did it?
I was actually, especially at that time, I was always really the youngest, the next Hickchen. I remember once with the band where I played, we had gigs. I was 17, I think. We played in Hamburg in the course of Freiheit, and they made fun because I wasn't actually officially allowed to walk through on the way to the course of Freiheit, and all the girls came out and stuff, and they made fun of me. But on the other side, yeah, I was quite confident in what to do. And I also think in a young age, you do not think too much about, if you're into it and you just go for it, kind of bit having this view. And I was lucky to have my first publisher, manager, who was the manager from Baldersalz, and who was booking our gigs in other bands. And I worked with him together quite early, and he gave me opportunities to work with Bartels, this comedy duo, or do some demo jobs for Sony, who were in Frankfurt still at that time, Sony Music. Luckily, so I could slip into that world more and more, yeah, from a low level. And I was the youngest. Yeah, that's true.
Growing up in Frankfurt, of course, at that time, and someone like Sven Fate would have been on your radar before you met him, I presume, because he'd already had these two off albums, hadn't he, by the time that you met him. How did you meet him, and what was your impression of him when you met him?
I knew, of course, like da-da-da-da, Electrica Salsa. I never liked it on the school parties. But he met then Matthias Hoffmann, the guitar player I used to play in the band when I was 17. And then a certain time, everybody did his own stuff. And he met Sven like in a cafe in Frankfurt. And they've been really fascinated by these two opposite worlds, DJ, musician. So they thought, let's do something together. That sounds interesting. And quite quickly, they started to found IQ Records on a very low level with the manager, Heinz Roth, who was managing Sven by that time. And then Matthias called me and said, listen, forget everything you've done so far with the pop stuff and pop production. We have to meet. This is really cool. It's going to be something really different. You have to meet Sven and you have to join the team. And this was how I met Sven then, actually, in the studio. And that time was Mosaic Studio, their project. And we just started to jam around doing some, I don't know what was the first thing we did with Sven, Barbarella, or even a remix from No Fate, something like this. And we figured out, oh, that works really well. We had a really good vibe from the beginning on.
So how did you actually test each other out? And were there certain roles that were sort of decided in that initial period?
I mean, they've worked together already. I did a lot of, even I was coming more from the pop, still pop rock influence side. I listened to electronic stuff, of course. I liked electronic music. I did a lot of demo productions, which I showed to Matthias and Sven, and I really liked it. So that's why I said, look, you have to come to the studio, you have to do something. And I think it was just not checking out, it was just, let's do try something together. I think it was a remix or something. I don't remember, actually. And we just did it and it went well. So, and that was it. Okay, cool. Let's do more.
So there wasn't a particular vision from either side. It was just doing.
Yeah, the vision was, I think that there was no vision really in that sense, because you have this guy coming from DJing and then you have this musicians who are always thinking chords and harmonies and stuff like this, and both sides telling each other, open your mind and let's be free. And Sven always said, let's be Freigeist, don't think about it. And we said, okay, and we could offer him things he couldn't do from our sides. Okay, let's be Freigeist, you can do like this and play this. And he said, well, cool, but let's cut it here and just repeat it or whatever. And I think the inspiration and the vision was just to go and to get each other's ideas, and because it's been so from different perspectives, which made it so interesting, especially in that time. Now it's normal, but in the 90s, beginning of 90s, it was like really, wow, let's just do something and go for it.
Was it an equal partnership from the beginning? Because you came into something where Sven was already a known figure. I mean, he wasn't a known figure in the music that you're about to make, but he was a known figure. So I just wondered at the beginning, or did you have to sort of develop that into an equal partnership at some point?
It was in the studio was, I have to say, really kind of an equal partnership, because I could see everybody was so inspired and thirsty at that time to suck out each other's ideas, and same as I was inspired by his open view in arrangements or structures or how to make music different, he was open to take our side from the musical side. And so on that level, you could really work on the same level. It never was like, I tell you what to do and you're just my musician, or other, I tell you what to do because you're just a DJ or whatever. It was always like on the same level, which makes it so effective also, I think.
I mean, it was a very exciting time in Frankfurt at that, during that period. You know, obviously IQ and Logic, and that was going on. And then, of course, you had the club scene. You had Omen, which Matthias, Sven, and Michael Munzing, I think.
At the beginning,
were the owners at the beginning. And then you had, of course, Dorian Gray at the airport that had been going, you know, a long time, but was still a phenomenal club. How exciting was that period for you? And can you tell me the first time you were in a club and you heard techno music and what it did to you?
Well, the time, of course, that was like really big time because it has been so concentrated, and Frankfurt is not big. And you had, as you said, actually everything was around two or three clubs happening. And we've been each weekend in the club, not just partying, of course, but also listening to the new stuff other producers did or DJs, and going back to the studio in the week. I don't know, I was in clubs several times before, of course, the Sven time already. I was also in the Dorian Gray already, but on the, it changed when you work together and start to make things or hear things different. And when I don't have this first time in the club thing, it kind of developed. It was really fast when it got into, but it was within a couple of months probably, but not the one time which changed my view of things. It came, but it came really quickly then, especially after starting to work intensely in this direction and forget about everything you did before. No song structure anymore, not 3 minutes or a chorus after, or got no vocals in the first years, no vocals allowed at all. You want to do it 10 minutes? So let's make a 10-minute track. Everything was, it doesn't matter.
You said that, you know, making music with Sven and going to a club gave you a different perspective than being a consumer, being someone like me going to a club and hearing music. What do you mean by that? What was the difference?
It has been for us such a new thing, kind of, that being in a club, listening to the music and what other, every week there was something new coming out, and you've been so amazed by the sounds, frequencies and whatsoever, that the inspiration also was so big after the weekend to go to the studio and make something new after listening to so much stuff. The experience has been so strong. I don't know how much the difference is like from when you listen to the stuff and you've been in the clubs, but we had the thing then, of course, after the weekend, when we went to work, it was a studio to work with what we experienced after the weekend. So it was like one continuous line, more or less. I didn't go back to a job and worked on something totally different, happy to wait for the weekend. It was like happy to wait for the weekend, but also happy to wait for the week to go to the studio again.
Was it also an experience where you were not only experience and listening to the music, you will also experience the reaction of people in the club to particular music?
It was, of course, then when you released your first stuff, and because especially in the beginning, it was more anonymous things. Like the music, the producer wasn't, the people didn't know who made the track. They just heard the track and they went crazy or not. And when you heard the track you did, and you could see the reaction of the people, it was such an uplifting feeling without being to have to be on some stage or something. You could enjoy it in the same way with the crowd. And that was quite a strong experience actually to have. And especially after a while when we released stuff once a month or twice a month, it has been quite intense.
I mean, I remember being in the Omen, and I remember like the first times that I was there. And I had the same experience, you know, in London, in acid house clubs like Shoom and so on. But it was because of the it was loud, it was repetitive, and it had this rhythm. It sort of transported me in a solitary way, yet with lots of people around me being transported in a solitary way. It was a different experience of listening to music than I had before, which is something that made it exciting as a consumer.
Yeah, that's true. I totally agree, because it was so much about the music also, and exactly as you mentioned it, is with the crowd, but you could be for yourself and just go with the flow somehow, and with the repetitive sounds, and you could be in a trance state. Doesn't matter if people took drugs or not, most of the people took drugs, but it's the music have been so such there was such a tension which just took you on a couple of hours journey if you wanted. Yeah,
I mean, you had a very long collaboration period with Sven, and I think it was over about 7 or 8 years. And then, you know, albums come out like An Accident in Paradise, Barbarella, The Harlequin, The Robot and The Ballet Dancer. And the way that you developed, you became in many ways the sort of center that other people, other musicians were looking at and being inspired by. How aware were you that you were both leaders in the sort of trance genre?
I don't know. I think not that much really in that time, because we've been so in our tunnel doing our stuff, and there's not much left on the left side, on the right side, because I think also sometimes probably we've been even kind of in an arrogant way, maybe, because I think it's especially for the age under 30, you just follow your aim without thinking too much about it. And we didn't read so much reviews and stuff like this, because there've been so much other stuff to do music wise. And it came later when you get this more intense recognition, which is then you get aware of it years later, which is, wow, that's quite a thing expected like this. And we knew that the stuff was strong, the music, we had successful releases, of course, and stuff, but we, as I said, not so much thinking about this particular view so much intensely that time.
I read an article that said that you were aware that having a collaborator in the studio, Sven, helped unify the sounds of the albums that you made that may have not been there if you had been alone. Can you explain that?
The good thing, especially in the beginning, the first two, three albums, and I was young and he was, and everything had been new. I did stuff he appreciated in a way, like on Accident in Paradise, you have instruments, flutes, cembalo. I never would have done this in that way on an ambient record. If I've been by myself, probably I would have thought too much about things. Can I do it or not? And then Sven was on the other side. You can do everything. If you like it, it's good. And I played around sometimes. Oh, that's nice. Let's use it. And it was like a classical cembalo little thing, whatever. And we just put it in, use it as an sample. Or on another album, we even had a flute player with a violinist on one track. Because if he liked it, it was good. But the good thing is, while I would have maybe thought too much about it sometimes, is it cool or not? He said, yeah, it's good. We make it. Let's do it. We love it. And so the both sides have been inspirational way to do things you wouldn't have done by yourself.
He also brought in field sounds, didn't he? Sounds of his travels in India or, you know. Yeah. And in a sense, when I read that, I thought, okay, well, that really corresponds to developing music for films or series. So do you think this was also, I know that you're also getting involved in making film music, but was this a sort of preparation for what was to come, in a sense?
Yeah, maybe. It's like this. What I liked about especially the first albums with Sven, for me, it was like similar to program music from the classical music. You have something in your mind and you describe it and make music, and the inspiration goes, and when the listener listens to it, he makes his own movie in his mind. And also with the structure of the music, like make it 10 minutes, whatever, no pattern structure. And this was my connection to the classical music, kind of, with the modern electronic sounding music. And with the film music, it's a bit similar. You do stuff for, well, then given situation scenes, but it can be also, there's a kind of a connection indeed. And I had the possibility to do my first film music in a collaboration. I was only 17. I just slipped in somehow as a keyboard player, and I could see, oh, that's something I could imagine to do more. But over the years, I didn't have so much options. It grew more and more.
I'll get on to film music in a minute, but I just want to talk a bit more about Sven, or ask one more question, because you mentioned about creating these images in your mind while you're composing. Did you exchange the ideas of the visual images that you were composing, sort of thing, at that time? Don't go away. Ralph will be answering that question in just a second. But just a moment for me to ask you, please, to subscribe to this channel. It helps me and it helps you, because you'll be the first to hear when I upload something new on this channel. Okay, let's get back to Ralph Hildenbeutel.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, I remember he came from, as you said, from India, Goa once, and with a duct tape, and I did a lot of field recordings, and let's use him. And he also had already a good complete idea for the album, Accident Paradise. Let's call it Accident Paradise, and this is going to be the theme, and we have paradise, but there's going to be also an accident. And so his vision was quite visual already, which helped then to do the music on top with that visual ideas he brought in, actually.
I mean, one of the film music pieces that you did, which was to sort of put you on the radar by getting awards, was the Hommage en Noir, which was directed by Ralph Schmerberg. How did that come about? And this, you know, this film is described as a poem to honor the culture of Africa, and it has no dialogue.
Yeah.
So I just wondered how, you know, if you think of film music that you've probably done since, and it's, you are creating the music in a sense with the dialogue in mind as well. So it's very different to do it without dialogue. What were the, I wouldn't say difficulties, but what did you have to overcome to do this? And what was your thinking when you went into it?
Yeah, I mean, that's indeed what really different. And one of the first, I haven't done so much film music by then. And then you do something like this, which is not a typical film music. It basically was to describe, you don't have to describe the pictures were there. So you have to give the mood. I had a lot of field recordings as well, original recordings, which I involved in the music, made it one with the music in many cues and scenes. And the idea was also to respect, homage the culture aspect from where he did the shootings and bring on some from the electronic side of our time, that on the 96, to make a melange of both worlds, kind of, to transport it through a modern sounding aesthetic.
Did Ralph approach you for that? He must have come to you because he'd heard your music or your contribution with Sven, I presume. And he came to you. What did he come to you with? Did he come to you with the finished film, or was the film re-edited around what you composed?
He came to, it was more like an IQ thing. He approached to IQ. I actually even don't know how they came together anymore. And they developed an idea. I think in the beginning he was planning to just use several music tracks, maybe to license them or maybe to ask somebody. And then with IQ, they developed an idea to make to completely movie with, the movie have been finished by then, to compose new original music for it. And that's how we internally come to the decision I could be the right man for it. And that's why how we came together. And while the film was edited more or less 100%, they had some temp tracks on it already, but I tried to be as free as possible from it so we could have really like an original music soundtrack and not nothing which sounds like copied from something in a way enough, etc. And he's been quite open to it, and it went really well, actually.
I mean, IQ was a, the record company was a, it was an interesting grouping because it had what seemed to be in that period immense success, and then it had really complicated issues going on towards the end, and there were financial problems and it went into insolvency and everything. How did that change from it working to it not working affect you in terms of your creativity? How were you able to sort of keep creating when above you all these issues are coming up?
Yeah, I think on the one side, it was kind of paradise for a musician to have this mid-scene above you and you just could do whatever you wanted. And for a couple of years, it went even well. Everybody was happy, and even financially, which is important, we had the system running. And with more success and the music scene changing after years, you have to look more how to also the label had to look how going to we define ourselves in the future, and trying to go more artist related with productions like Vernon, Dalicia, the BZ with Dalicia track, to have not just this 12-inch thing. The only artist on IQ by then was long form artist was Sven, actually, with the albums and some other projects, but trying to develop other artists on a to make it sensible after a while. But it didn't went so well as expected. And on the other side, the label wanted to grow more and more. And I think that was a little bit the problem, trying to grow more, going to Berlin, making a bigger office. And but the product wasn't there to finance it at the end of the day. And since IQ worked together with Warner, was a label from Warner Records at that time, at a certain point when the money is gone, you know how it is, then you have to see how you go on. But I think that was the point of no return when it went down. And for us, Stevie, Matthias, and I, who run the studios, we decided to stay in Frankfurt and not go to Berlin, which was good because we haven't been involved in a bankruptcy. And we changed our direction as well then, late 90s, because for us, the techno thing was kind of, everything was set for a while, has been done. And we thought we have to do something else now.
And it was quite an interesting choice that you made. Yeah. And I completely understand your decisions, because you meant, you know, you're saying that that era was essentially over and you had to go into a new directions. So what did you want to achieve with this, which was much more a sort of commercial popularist direction that you went in with the company Schaubau?
Well, after doing this music for like 7-8 years so intensely, it was kind of refreshing to say, and now we go, we do something new again, which was not new for us, because we've done pop tracks before, before the techno time. And so we thought, let's work artist related. Let's look for artists we can produce and work for. And let's try to make good classical pop songs, but bring in our influence from the whole electronic 90s era. And that was kind of an interesting challenge for us, because it was back to the future a little bit, but also into the future, combining those two worlds. And that's what we quite did intensely with several artists. Songs, artist-oriented, but keeping this electronic vibe we lived for so many years before.
I mean, you worked with really big names in Germany at that time, with Yvonne Katterfeld, with Leith Audin. And I think what's really fascinating is that earlier you said that techno broke all conventions. And now you are working with
back the conventions.
Back to conventions, yeah. But bringing partly of what you'd learnt and expressed in the decade before into this new music. How was that period for you creatively? And was it really a decision for you to be able to keep going? And do you view that period differently than you view the sort of techno era of the 10 years before?
Yeah. I mean, definitely. The 90s techno era have been really a very strong, intense. You're not lucky to have this situation often in life. And we've been lucky, I've been lucky to be there, because you have to be in the right time and the right place as well to do this. And it happened. And this is rare. And we are aware, I was always really aware of it, how rare it is, because I could have been somewhere else a couple of years later or earlier, and I wouldn't have the opportunity to do that. The pop music thing is, of course, something different. It was more like an approach to say, I really want to try to do some proper pop music, and as good, it's kind of a new challenge, because it has been an inspiration to do something else, actually, because I'm not somebody who can do the same thing for decades. It's music, I do it for decades, but within, I like to challenge other directions. And this was just kind of a relief for us to say, we don't have to do the perfect, coolest techno track or ambient album anymore. We just do something else. And we work with artists and go that direction. Now, when I see it, surely the 90s era has been more important than the pop era. But it has been for me also an important bridge, the pop era, to go where I am now properly. Seeing after a while, I won't do pop music for the rest of my life. Even though I've been in London doing songwritings, everything, it was really amazing and nice, but I needed that for my way to go where I am now, I guess.
Yeah, so because the last 15 years, you've been really in the 15 years, okay, there's some music of your own and so on and so forth, and produced other artists as well, but the majority of it seems to have been film music, and film music has taken a greater importance into your life. Was that a conscious decision to move, well, you've done some before, so to move back into that area.
Yeah, I think I have to be honest with the pop music. I've done lovely projects. I met lovely people. It's been successful. I was a bit bored after a while. And also, it's really hard. You write like 70 songs, and if you get 10 songs pitched, you're already in a good level. And you speak to others, they wrote 100 songs and had maybe 2 songs pitched. It's just such a waste of energy and creative energy. And so I forced it. I really wanted to go more and more into the film music thing, which took a while also, because you've been always the techno head kind of. And it took really a while to establish there more. If you're not coming from that side, especially in Germany, if you don't have this classical, like I studied composing, they think you cannot be a good film composer. Luckily, in that time, with the old streaming and everything, it opens much the from composing side for the film music. It opens from what you could do and where musicians came from background-wise doing film music, which was like the perfect timing for me, especially when I started to do more international stuff.
I mean, I read that you actually worked on Verbotene Liebe, which is a German soap opera, Forbidden Love, for people not speaking German. And it's interesting because that is obviously a sausage factory. Do you know what I mean? They're turning over so many programs. And to work on that, on the music, really, I presume, is a massive learning process for what was to come. What did you learn from that experience?
It's exactly while I did some movies and projects before, when this job came, I did it together with Stevie Bizet. We knew this is going to be very intense because it was a daily format. So we had to do every day music for 45 minutes episode. And I was sure this is probably not something for the rest of my life. But this 3 or 3.5 years we did it, it was so intense. I learned so much in terms of being effective, working on a high level without having artist attitudes, just be professional and effective. And I took a lot of stuff, even if it was a soap, a sausage factory soap thing, I took a lot out of it. I think it's a good school, definitely.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about it is because there's such a quick turnover of the program, I'm wondering whether that quick turnover actually gave you more freedom. Do you know what I mean? Because maybe they haven't got time to check everything you're doing. Was it like that?
A little bit. I mean, you worked with like, I don't know, 20, 30 directors, because it's always changed. And then after a while, you knew this guy is easy, she's easy, he's going to be more complicated. Some just let it go, what you do, you did your stuff with a freedom. Others have been really picky, and you thought, well, this is not a movie. We don't have the time to go in every queue like you do. Yeah, but it's so important. So you had to handle every kind of characters from that side also. Sometimes you've been free, sometimes they tortured you, like for a bloody episode from the Daily Soap. You had to like go still late night to do little fixes, and you thought nobody going to take care of it because it's going to be waiting for the next day already. Quite amazing.
Brilliant. I love that idea.
I don't want to do it again, but I can tell you it's kind of been kind of true. I was really kind of, there came a time when I thought I cannot do it anymore, because also always the same. But then eventually it stopped by itself. They quit it. And I thought it's good that the decision came from outside, because it's, of course, you make a lot of money when you do like daily on a stage channel format. But I was happy when it ended.
I mean, I know you've worked on so many projects in between, but I do want to talk about Super Sex, so I have to get this in now. How did you get approached for that series? And what did the director, Manieri, say to you when she met you?
So luckily, when a couple of years ago, I had the thing that I came into the Italian production thing. I started to work with Italian productions, and from that point, it was kind of a snowball thing after the first thing I did, and one after the other came. So I, in the last years, I mainly worked for Italian production and directors. And so that's how it came with SuperSex, because they knew stuff I've done before and they asked me. And it was kind of a funny thing when the guy called me, we wanted to ask you if you want to do music for us. Here's about the guy. An email, Rocco Siffredi. And I didn't know Rocco Siffredi. I know most everybody knows when I say Rocco Siffredi, Rocco Siffredi. I didn't know what to do with the name. So I Googled Rocco Siffredi. I was like, oh, okay, here we go. That's interesting. And I thought, yeah, why not? I know it was like a proper serious company and everything. So, and for Netflix. So I thought, okay, it's going to be some serious thing. And then the talking stuff, Manieri was the showrunner. And I had three directors. I was brought in by actually one of the directors, Francesca, who saw stuff I did in Italy. And it have been a lot of talkings because it's have been such a delicate theme, and there have been a lot of discussions between producers, directors, Netflix, not to go too dark, how dark can we go, how pushy we need to be, how fun we need to be, and all this, but finding the right balance. And it has been a really like a long process actually on this show.
I mean, it's interesting. I've actually interviewed Rocco Siffredi. A friend of mine was making a documentary about the porno industry in Hollywood when I was on holiday there about 20 years ago. And so she was going to the Hustler building where all these porn stars were putting their hands in concrete, like the Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
And I always wondered, why did they put their hands in concrete? But anyhow, Rocco Siffredi, I think it was him. I mean, I know I interviewed him, but I interviewed Big Ron and all these other porn stars and female porn stars. And I think he was there with his mother. It was for me, not knowing that industry at all, yeah, it was a very family-oriented industry, which really was a bit shocking for me. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
This is really weird. And I mean, it was quite an experience to be there. And I like what you said about I know that Netflix were very, it's been a very sensitive process because, you know, making a series about a porn star, they didn't want to explode it into, you know, exploiting sort of things. And especially in an era that we live today. So what I found interesting about your music, it's really like you're delving into different eras and delving into different influences. How did you actually approach it once you got the brief?
I mean, it's probably have been, the most eclectic score I've ever done. And it's because of all this, like for the Italians, the series is kind of, and the main actor said, it's kind of like a sexual, in the film-wise, a revolution, because they never have sex scenes really in their movies and in the series. They have everything else. They do great movies, but kind of this prudery. And for many Italians, that's like this bigotry, double moral standards. And for them, it's kind of doing this about Rocco Siffredi is so revealing. Others are so, how can you do something like about the porn star and glorify him and stuff? And I think that's all mirrored also in the story from the series. And while they had this strong emotional part with family, brother, relation to the mother, and the showrunner Manieri, she wanted to have it kind of, she said even, think about great movies like Once Upon a Time in America and stuff like this. And I wasn't being like, what is this? Is something completely different, like a porn star and this coming up with this movie. But I understood later what she wanted to tell. She wanted to dive deep into the family saga thing about the decades. And then on the other side, of course, you have porn sets, fun shoots, and 80s and 90s and all. the sexual clubs and everything like this. So everything came together. So I had to do kind of emotional orchestral pieces for the all this emotional path, and then in the next episode, even in the 80s, and you have to do 80s music, grabbing all the my old synthesizers here and doing stuff like this. And then the next one is in the 90s, and then you go back to drama, orchestra, and then try to bring it a little bit together so it's not too, it's still one story, right? Trying to involve the themes in all these different style, music styles, electronic or strings or piano, whatever. So, I mean, quite amazing to do it, but quite intense also, in fact.
How did you bring the contradictions that you talked about before, about sort of the idea of religion, of Italy, of sex, and then, of course, of masculinity, and what does masculinity mean, which is a sort of central theme of the series, that all those sort of conflicting things, how did you bring those together in single tracks?
Not so easy to describe. I mean, I often start not just, you see, how can I say? It's the scene, it's a cue, it's a situation which needs music. And then above it comes the feeling which you need to transport. It's then not just a situation, because you have to think about the actor, not the actor, the character, and what's the mean. It's not just a fun thing now, so make it a bit more spicy. Or it's very dramatic, but there's also a lucky part in it. So it's from situation to situation, thinking, actually, trying and to combine it. And then you go over it again and again, and also recompose things and try to connect themes to bring all these things together, that you hear something, a theme, a motive from one emotional part in a more electronic, happy piece, then you still have this little edge which connects it in a certain way. I don't know if it makes sense what I'm trying to explain here.
I mean, you mentioned when you worked for Verbotene Liebe and that TV series, and that occasionally you would be sent back to change something and have to work on it overnight. This is, you know, this is a big thing. This is a big, expensive series made by Netflix, which is a huge company. And I just wondered what control and what pressures were there on you in terms of what you had to do, or were you given pretty much creative freedom?
I think bigger it gets, the more you have to be able to see it as a team playing things, and more cooks you have and more people saying things. And sometimes you have, which is sometimes not so easy at the composer, director has a vision, producer has a vision, Netflix has a vision. Netflix is the boss, but still director says, I want it like this. And then briefings, notes, we have to push it more. And then the director goes to you, yeah, but we keep it a bit like this way. And in the end, they think, is the composer not able to do what we say? And I think, no, I do what you want, but you have to get it sorted in the whole team. So there is, everybody was really nice. That's a good thing. Never arguing, fighting. But there is a pressure, because especially for Netflix, it was a delicate thing to have this show. So everybody wanted to do it perfect. They even did some reshootings shortly before the mixing and stuff like this. So just to see how much they rethought things, and even music included. I think 1.5 year working on that show is quite longer than most of the other stuff I've done so far, because they're moving the release again, because they wanted to rethink about things, etc., etc.
I mean, so the music for this show has gotten an incredible reception, and people are really talking about it. How gratifying has it been for you after going through that whole process and creating, as you said, all these different styles and somehow having a theme going on at the same time. How gratifying has it been to actually have this as a real success, as a big success?
Yeah, it's really lovely because I say it's the on the one side is the best paid portfolio I can ever imagine because it can show everything. But no, it's also because you never know how it ends up. If you do something, it could have been a total flop, or people hate it, or I was so happy that it went, even still discussed, diverse and polarizing. It was a success, and the reception for the music was really, really good. And this, yeah, it's like the honey which goes down like this. Yeah, you can after a while waiting and find its release, and then you don't know how's the reaction. And especially when the music gets an extra recognition, which is not, you don't have it often. That is, people talk about music, even if it's great or not great. But in this case, it was really nice to see that. Yeah.
I mean, you talked about your piano teacher when you were very young, and how that experience gave you so much experience into different types of music. And you said at the beginning of this interview how that has played into your life, throughout your life, and particularly in this, it seems to have had an incredible importance.
Absolutely, especially a project like this, where I had, as I said, I've been doing classical pieces for orchestra and doing all the string arrangements. I had to do a piano piece, like a Schumann, Chopin-esque style, where the girl plays the piano, gets more and more wild, and then they ask me, can you really, it's a long montage, and I did a 5.5 minutes piece. In the end, of course, they cut it down to 1 minute and then changed the music to orchestra. But I've done all this. And then on the other side, with the bass, the influence and all the stuff from the 90s, which I could use. And I was so grateful that I have these two, mainly these two sides, the strong piano education, a piano, not just piano, classical theory and everything she gave me, and then the electronic nerd times to be able to do all that stuff. I wouldn't know how, probably they would have to exchange the composer if I could do it like this, or add another one. I have no idea.
Have you noticed that this has opened up new doors for you?
Well, not yet. I noticed a lot of reaction, nice positive reaction, but I didn't have like 10 new offers on the table yet. Let's see. I noticed the recognition is very, very big, and I'm sure many, not only Italian film people, seen it. And so I'll take it relaxed and easy, and maybe something is coming. Would be grateful. Yeah.
No, I think it is. Well, Ralph Hildenboy, thanks very much. I mean, I really want to say a big appreciation for what you've done in your life, partly in the era with Sven, of course, which was, you know, also an important era in my life. But what I love about it is that I think you're approaching a sort of new era for you, which will be bigger and better, and obviously in film music. So I really hope that comes to you now. Ralph, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me. I was really pleased for the invitation. Thanks a lot.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.